Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on this show, we'll talk Albertsons and Instacart, also Kroger, as well as Black Friday post-mortem details, and we'll talk about Sears. We'll have an interview as well with Brett Bernstein. He's the CEO and founder of Gatsby. He's going to talk about micro-influencers on today's show and exactly what they mean to the retail landscape. But first this, you know about the perks that come with owning your own business, like financial freedom, being your own boss, and having more control of your time. But maybe you're just not sure where to start. All of this, though, could potentially be yours if you choose to open a UPS store franchise.
The UPS store brings in over 35 years of franchising experience, and they were just ranked the number 4 top franchise to own by Entrepreneur Magazine's 2017 Franchise 500 list. They bring in stability, the support and reputation of a world-renowned brand, and a proven business model with all the training and marketing support you'll need to make your entrepreneurial dreams come true.
Stores are available in large and small markets across the country, and they have franchising experts who will help you find a location that's just right for you. Plus, there's financing for those who qualify and special programs for military veterans. The time to promote yourself to business owner could be now. Visit theupsstorefranchising.com/focus to get started today. That's theupsstorefranchising.com/focus. Well, we begin this episode of the Retail Focus with grocery giant Kroger. The company has outlined plans to ensure supplier timeliness. We'll also look into how strong results from their latest quarter may push back the idea that recent sales upticks at Walmart and goings-on at Amazon may affect their business. All of this comes as Kroger made the news first this week by ending a relationship with third-party supplier Southstar LLC. Southstar operated a facility in Keller, Texas, and they said that all of the nearly 700 workers there with Southstar would be let go and that a new supplier, Penske, will be taking over. Now, this will commence on Sunday, December 10th. Workers here have openly complained that they feel like the layoff notices didn't give them enough time to prepare and that they'll be significantly hurt during the holiday season. But as far as this third-party supplier news goes, Leighton, obviously there's a lot of stuff going on with Kroger this week, but first came this news that they were moving to Penske.
When you're looking at Kroger, especially a massive powerhouse in the grocery space like Kroger, they're going to always be looking at their suppliers and in terms of quality, obviously, safety protocols, that type of thing. So this isn't really that surprising. What really took me by surprise was the fact that 700 people would be let go. And like you said, Trent, a lot of people were complaining that we're working at this facility, that it's going to hurt their families because the holidays are coming up and they're going to be having to spend money for their families. And that's money they will no longer have. However, for Penske's part, a spokesperson for that company said that they actually intend to recruit existing employees from the warehouse in addition to outside candidates. The company is currently negotiating with labor unions and representatives that work with those warehouse workers. And so most likely they will be rehiring some of those people that are affected from this Southstar shutdown. But the sheer amount of people that were affected, 700, that's sure to make media headlines. But I'm sure a lot of them are going to actually come back into the fold, and that Kroger was really just wanting a new operator, somebody that they felt was a little bit more competent. And this is something that plays into Kroger's business overall, Trent, because you look at the statements made by Kroger representatives and executives over the past few months. They understand that the company needs to really hone down in cost cutting, but also look at the business and what they do best in terms of overall operations. And I think by looking at your third-party suppliers, especially those here domestically, that is an important part of their business and something they should be doing at all times. So this is interesting because of the sheer amount of people that were affected and that this is so close to their earnings call. This actually came out about a week prior to their earnings call this week. But this move to switch suppliers is one that most likely is brought on by the fact that the company has continually looked for ways to increase their quality, increase the ways in that they manage their supply chain. So a lot of questions surround this, but related to the story that is happening in Texas, Kroger is also looking elsewhere, not only to cut costs, but ensure product delivery is punctual. This story comes via the Cincinnati Business Courier, a publication out of Kroger's home base, obviously. The company is planning on fining suppliers that are late on certain shipments. So here you have two different stories, Trent. One really about quality and managing a little bit more in a micro level your suppliers, but also looking at when these deliveries for these suppliers that they currently have in the fold are going to actually deliver the product and holding them accountable and making sure those deliveries come on time. Studies show that there are lost sales up to $75 billion annually due to items that are sold out. So obviously Kroger is wanting a piece of that pie back. If you don't have a particular item, potentially you're losing customers to another business, another competitor. This doesn't always take into account substitute goods. One example that we would talked about before the podcast airing is the fact that maybe somebody comes in for ice cream or some dessert good, their favorite brand is sold out. Well, they're not going to end up going 2 miles to another store. They're probably just going to get their second favorite brand of that one thing. Kroger is still trying to reduce this inherent risk of lost business, however, despite the option of substitute goods. Moreover, they are more likely trying to alleviate customer frustrations and create a more reliable customer expectation framework overall. If you think about it, you may get your second favorite brand of whatever it is you came in the store to get. However, you still are disappointed at the end of the day that Kroger or whatever Kroger subsidiary didn't have the product you came there and intended to get. Kroger is looking to charge some of its suppliers, therefore, a blanket fee of $500 per day for missed shipments. Some other companies, namely Walmart, charge a daily rate based on the percent of the shipment value. Senior Vice President Robert Clark was quoted by the Wall Street Journal in saying that it's a massive opportunity from a financial and customer standpoint, really driving home the idea that the initial theory here is that it's more than just the bottom line. It's about brand awareness, how people view the Kroger brand. Kroger's in-house analytics firm most likely has been looking at ways to increase supplier incentives to deliver on time, because this is not just about the profit. Is it about the customer expectation, having customers coming to your store and knowing what you have or don't have?
And I know that a lot of grocery and retail businesses talk oftentimes about being customer-centric, but Kroger really has driven this home over the last 3 or so years, acknowledging the fact that there are challenges coming from the grocery industry, acknowledging the fact that obviously food deflation has presented a challenge over the last year or two. They've focused on ways to make Kroger more appealing to those shoppers that do come in store. And I think they feel like this policy not only is good fiscal sense, but also it puts accountability back on the shoulders of the suppliers for making sure the suppliers bring those shipments so that Kroger doesn't suffer in the eyes of the public. Now let's talk about that robust earnings call, where shares ended the day Thursday up over 6% on great news from the grocery retailer. And something Bloomberg noted, the shares initially popped around 14%, which was the largest pop on Kroger's share price since 1993. Now, this comes after months of declines, although the stock had been up recently over the last week or so. The three main reasons for the share declines over the last couple of quarters include management discussing a restructuring and also issuing tepid guidance for the rest of the full year. Additionally, elimination of long-term guidance also hit the shares a little bit, but that's rather in line with a lot of public companies nowadays. And then, of course, the Whole Foods acquisition by Amazon that took just about every retailer that sells groceries down on that particular day 5 to 10%. Shares have recently gone as low for Kroger in the $19 range, but Thursday hit as high as $27.70. So let's get to the results. Third quarter revenue saw a slightly better than modest increase of 4.5% to $27.75 billion. They beat analyst estimates by $290 million. Now, some of this 4.5% increase caused by higher fuel prices across the board, but also some caused by same-store sales and also the build-out of new locations. Speaking of those same-store sales, they saw a 1.1% rise in same-store sales, excluding fuel. that beat average analyst guidance of 0.9%. So able to beat that by a slim margin, despite the fact that we talk about food inflation, we're still not seeing it yet to this point. And a lot of that same store sale rise was due to traffic being driven up slightly. Now, one thing Kroger did mention throughout this earnings call is talking about discounting. And they mentioned that discounting will be key for this reporting period, not only the third quarter, but also for the fourth quarter and the sales that will be reflected in the fourth quarter. Something that we referenced during this week's Food Focus was the fact that restaurants saw a bump in Black Friday traffic, but grocers also experienced a bit of a pre-Thanksgiving and Thanksgiving Day bump, at least according to the data that's come out early on. Discounts may play into a part of that. Net income for the company also rose year over year to $397 million, but only increased 1.5% as the company continues to reinvest some of their profits into a number of projects, including the store pickup programs they've got, again called ClickList there at Kroger, store remodels, as well as pay increases and hiring. And the latter two, something that we've heard a lot about from grocers and retailers in general, as again, the overall employment numbers continue to creep up a little bit. Companies are having a hard time retaining or recruiting employees unless they bump those salaries up or unless they bump those wages up. And that's something that Kroger's had to do. But also Kroger's been transparent about being very bullish this year, more so than most, towards their seasonal hiring, especially as it pertains to some of their marketplace locations and some of their larger locations, like, for example, Fred Meyer in the Northwestern United States. Fewer outstanding shares because the company's bought back plenty of shares meant that earnings per share did grow at a faster rate, 44 cents per share for the latest quarter versus last year's 41 cents per share. This beat analyst expectations by a good 10%.
Well, as we end the story about Kroger's earnings, we'll quickly go through their prepared remarks. Kroger management noted that their restructuring plan included four main bullet points associated with sustainable strategy. This is called, or what they called, Restock Kroger. They talked about this a lot in these prepared remarks. We look at these four main bullet points, and this is something that the company has really been alluding to over the past couple of quarters as they do restructure their business and look at what they do best. They talk about redefining the customer experience, making the customer experience a little bit better, expanding partnerships, which they really didn't say what this included, but we can assume it means product vendors, and also their omnichannel capabilities. They want to develop their talent, which Trent talked about as far as increasing pay, and all of the hiring frenzy that they've been a part of over the last several months. And they want to live their purpose, really meaning that they want to be able to share their values with their customer, with their employees, and come together with one solid goal in mind. They said that executing on all of these points will, in turn, lead to shareholder value. And this is something that they talk about all the time. They talk about reinvestment, and they don't want shareholders and analysts to get too concerned because they always try to point out that earnings per share does grow on a consistent basis within Kroger. You saw that this quarter as they grew and beat by around 4 cents per share. And they also, and we'll get into this, but they reiterated earnings per share guidance too. So they are focused on profitability, but they want to be sustainable for the long term. They talk about 1,000 ClickList locations now, whereas a couple years ago, they just had a few. And now digital sales growth of 109%. This includes those ClickList purchases. And home delivery now at 300 locations. This was at zero 13 months ago. So you can imagine how quickly these programs are growing. And they're growing not only because they're wanting to have more customer awareness, they want to bring more customers into the fold, but they must be profitable. Overall, they're seeing a lot of positive response, especially from the ClickList locations that they've grown throughout the Midwest. They partnered with nearly every service as it pertains to home delivery now, with Uber, Shipt, Instacart, which is a company we'll talk about in our last story, and others. And you see here with Instacart, they're talking about a lot of analytics they're bringing into the fold, something that some of these other companies may not be able to do, namely Uber and Shipt. Instacart really brings in the idea that sharing and being transparent with your partners is going to be good for all parties. Brands they have in-house now make up 28.2% of unit sales, which is a good thing, something they always try to tout because they have higher margins. However, they are usually at a lower price point. Therefore, those in-house brands now make up only 25.6% of sales versus that volume that I just mentioned. focusing on costs where it matters. They said this a lot throughout their prepared remarks. We say that it matters because they're willing to spend $500 million more on compensation and sustainability acts within their stores into 2019, but they think they can actually lower cost of goods sold also, therefore increase margins long term to enable earnings per share growth that they have become known for, like I had mentioned. Also, $9 billion in capital expenditures to become faster, not only in terms of point of sale systems, we talk about being able to have those self-checkouts installed at every one of their businesses, but also with every piece of their business as it pertains to the supply chain. They want to be a little bit more agile. We talk about the meal kit delivery, those kinds of things all play into this role here with capital expenditures. The company reiterated full-year earnings per share guidance between $2 and $2.05 per share, a good thing for analysts here. They see fourth quarter same-store sales matching the third quarter's, which, as Trent mentioned, came in at a positive 1.1%, which means they will actually miss consensus estimates here in the fourth quarter, however, by a narrow margin. In our view, we would not actually be surprised to see a beat here, considering the momentum they've alluded to with those holiday sales, even with those discounts. They're bringing in a lot of traffic due to those customers that are shopping around the Kroger locations. The company is still having to pay out pension obligations, which is one of the bad spots, one of the gray areas for this most recent earnings call. And similar to what Sears and other legacy companies have had to do for those longer term employees that have since retired. But they said that this week, they're actually going to have to spend $350 to $500 million related to those specific pension obligations. Shares were up, like Trent said, and ended trading Thursday around $25.86 per share, and have traded down another 20 cents as of Friday. Still, a price-to-earnings ratio around 15.5, pretty healthy considering one of their biggest competitors, Walmart, has a nearly 23 price-to-earnings ratio, 24 if you're looking at Friday's trading from a trailing basis. And you see the market cap for Kroger coming in around $23 billion, which again is not bad. Another thing you can look at in terms of competition, Whole Foods was recently bought by Amazon for $13.7 billion, yet Kroger is much, much larger, not only in terms of store footprint, brand awareness, but they have 2,800 locations throughout the United States.
On to our second story. We're talking actually for the first time in a while at a long form story about Sears as they report another massive loss in their quarterly report, but one that came in not as severe as last year. So anytime you see improvement on the loss front, maybe some optimism there at Sears, although we tend to argue it's simply because they have fewer stores out there to lose money. 3 weeks after equities analyst Bill Dreher voiced concerns about whether Sears will ever return to profitability, Sears has come out with a mixed but mostly negative third quarter earnings report. To be exact, the retailer's net loss came in at $558 million, and many said this was a narrowing because of last year's $748 million loss, but this is still a large sum and also a figure in line with the company's prior guidance. All this, yet the company still touts annualized cost savings reaching $1.25 billion. Again, this is something that's easy to do when closing locations and exiting entire markets. When you close locations like this, you no longer have the opportunity to lose money in those locations. Although one would argue, or a cynic would argue, if you close all locations, technically you maximize your cost savings and you lose zero year over year because you don't have a company left. Earnings per share loss here of $5.19 per share, which is still a massive figure, adjusted earnings per share loss of $2.64 thanks to some real estate sales. So with those adjusted, those one-time expenditures boosting that adjusted EPS, you get that bump up to $2.64. There were still same-store declines at both banners, Sears and Kmart, and the trend continues where Sears is seeing more serious drops in comparable marks than Kmart. Kmart sales still fell 13% year over year for stores that were open at least 1 year. Sears saw 17% declines. Now keep this in mind, Kmart's same store sales declines were nowhere near this bad a year or a year plus ago. So what this tells us, with all the Kmart stores that have been closed in the last couple of years, they're closing some of the better operating locations. Either that, or they're just operationally absolutely failing at Kmart, and I think it's probably a little bit of both, but we know for sure that they have been in the past closing some of the better performing locations at Kmart, which has raised a few eyebrows throughout the retail landscape. The company did bring in $3.7 billion for the fiscal third quarter, compared with $5 billion a year ago. That makes around 6 years of quarterly declines now, excluding one-time sales of real estate or sales of brands as well. This is a function of several hundred less locations. Of course, a lot fewer locations this year than they had last this calendar year. They've closed nearly 340 stores. They're set to close 100 more through February of 2018. Now, obviously, in an earnings call such as this, it was painted in somewhat of a positive light by a lot of media outlets, and still, again, a lot of that positivity just predicated on closing a number of stores that either weren't operating at a high clip or selling off the real estate to kind of bolster that bottom line. But there are potential opportunities looking ahead as well.
Sears and Kmart, these are two companies that obviously Trent and I both grew up with. And it's a sad thing to have to report on these falling sales and then also the net income loss here that we see quarter over quarter. It's particularly sad when you see locations that you grew up around having to shutter their doors. And like Trent said, particularly some locations that aren't in those bad areas of cities, metropolitan areas. Stores that were probably performing quite well, but the company wanted to extract the real estate value, therefore they could actually keep open all of the other stores. So sad times for Kmart, but this is actually a good thing for the company that they were able to stem some of their losses here during this quarter, and that they'll actually be able to escape 2017 without a bankruptcy. We look at some of the reasons to blame during this most recent earnings call during the fourth quarter. We see a softening of a lot of segments, including electronics and pharmacy closings. When Trent and I were attending shop.org in LA, we visited a couple Kmarts, and that was one thing we were really disappointed with, because Kmart used to have a comparable consumer electronics business to that of a Target or a Walmart. But now you go in, you may see only five or six different TVs. You may see a very small Blu-ray or DVD selection, and that is pretty much it with the other little things like accessories and things of that nature. And I think this is one area that they really should improve on if they were trying to be a sustained business. Because if you go into these stores, especially during the holiday season, and we'll talk about this during the 2017 Black Friday sales, but consumer electronics is making up a large piece of the holiday shopping pie. And if you don't participate, you don't get a piece of the pie. And so if you're looking also at the company functions and the different segments that are losing out, pharmacy, they've closed a lot of the pharmacies with inside their Kmarts. This is something that made a lot of news rounds because this is also a sector that's seeing increased sales year over year. We report on Walgreens, we report on CVS, Rite Aid, all of those businesses see long-term growth in the retail pharmacy industry. Now, whether those companies are performing at their highest level or not, the overall market opportunity is expanding for pharmacy. So to see closings with Kmart pharmacies, that's not a good thing for the company. They've also had issues with suppliers either pulling out or being timid with robust longer-term agreements because of liquidity worries surrounding the company. And this is a smart thing for those third-party suppliers. Let's be honest, those third-party suppliers are privy to the public earnings statements as we are. Why would you sign a longer-term agreement with Kmart or Sears and hope to get all of the money coming in from those agreements if you know the company has even warned about their potential to go forth long-term? So the company themselves have made statements about the goings-on and the ability to maintain through 2018. So you really would have to wonder why and how any supplier would sign these longer-term agreements. But overall, what that means for the consumer or for those investors out there is that they're not going to have as big of a product mix. The company thinks they can be successful and really try to diminish their store footprint longer term. They think that smaller footprint locations are actually optimal. So maybe they don't care about having that robust product mix. But if you look at statements by CFO Rob Riker, on these prepared statements, he said that we will build on the success of our recently opened dedicated concept stores to continue delivering specialized integrated retail experiences to our members in the upcoming quarters. And I think this really has a lot to do with how they're redeveloping some locations in and around malls in particular. You think of Sears having a lot of mall locations. Well, these locations are quite big, but they've actually worked with a lot of mall operators in order to redevelop these locations, cutting them in half a lot of times, being able to lease out the other portion of that real estate. And this is a win-win, I think. This is a win-win for Sears because those lease agreements are going to be a little less expensive, and a win for those mall operators because Sears is not leaving entirely. Plus, that opens up another opportunity for maybe a more popular retailer to come in next to Sears and drive traffic to the rest of your mall operations. They are hoping to have smaller appliance and mattress-only stores also and use these as an omni-channel hub for their online assortment in other categories. Apparel, for instance, has long suffered in the Sears brand, so it may be doubtful to create any real meaningful gains in this particular area, considering all the lost traction in their traditional brick-and-mortar stores. But for them to be able to have these omni-channel hubs, that is an important thing if they were to execute at a high level. That will mean more sales overall, and you don't have to carry that inventory in store. So it is a win-win down the line if this does in fact work. Sears is also leveraging its DieHard automotive battery brand by opening DieHard Auto Centers in Texas and Michigan. These are a little bit smaller centers, actually equivalent in size to their previous tire centers, a lot of which they've been closing over the last few quarters. Also, more of the same over the last 5 years from their CEO, Eddie Lampert. On this earnings call, he actually blamed a challenging retail landscape, which, as we know, is not the case. Retail sales are actually going up in both brick and mortar and e-commerce by double digits. And he says that overall, their cost savings initiatives are looking to streamline operations and reducing inventory and minimizing operating expenses. But we know that that really has only meant for the company shutting down current locations and laying off employees. Most recently, Trent, it looks as though financially they are still going to sustain through the early parts of 2018, thanks to not only a line of credit, but their overall cash and cash equivalents balance.
Yeah, and we were a little bit off in our initial prediction of a potential bankruptcy. We were eyeballing early 2018. The company does have $700 million of its $1.5 billion revolving line of credit left to use. So it's got a little bit of runway. But again, when you look at losses by GAAP measures, your generally accepted accounting practices measures of around $500 million per quarter, that $700 million only gets you quarter and a half in the future, and this revolving line of credit is due in 2020. The company showed nearly $200 million in cash on its balance sheet, so that adds a little bit to its run rate, only $58 million less than last year. Real estate sales have helped to fund pension obligations and also added to their bottom line. $270 million in real estate sales this quarter, but over $100 million worth after the third quarter's reporting period ends. So they continue to cash in on the real estate from all of these closures. Let's look at shares now. They spiked in the early morning Wednesday by as much as 19%. From 390 before the earnings call to highs of 535 Thursday, now all the way back down to 390, as everyone remembered that after all, this is Sears we're talking about and Sears Holdings that we're talking about here. So the optimism was short-lived. Shares are down 58% for the calendar year, 88% for the last 5 years. This is going to be a stock that a lot of people are putting in short-term speculative plays on, but again, long-term, both Layton and myself fail to see exactly the plan that Eddie Lampert is putting forth. And again, any makings of a turnaround, and you saw the word turnaround show up in some articles, really this bottom line was just bolstered by real estate sales. And once you run out of real estate, you run out of things to do in order to turn a profit with the company. And Layton addressed this, but the fact that Eddie Lampert mentioned the challenging retail landscape, it sounds like he was a retailer in 2016, at the beginning of 2016. But right now, the grand majority of companies are showing positive same-store sales, particularly when you look across general merchandise retailers such as Kmart, for example, and even JCPenney coming in with decent sales numbers. So I think the challenging retail landscape is easing a little bit, especially with all the Black Friday numbers we just got and sales being up on the Black Friday. It just looks like the retail turnaround may leave Sears and Kmart behind. Well, we mentioned this at the top of the show, but you know about the perks that come with owning your own business, like financial freedom, being your own boss, and having more control of your time, but maybe you're just not sure where to start. All of this could potentially be yours, though, if you choose to open a UPS Store franchise.
The UPS Store brings in over 35 years of franchising experience, and they were just ranked the top four franchise to own by Entrepreneur Magazine's 2017 Franchise 500 list. The UPS Store offers stability, the support and reputation of a world-renowned brand, and a proven business model with all the training and marketing support you'll need to make your entrepreneurial dreams come true. Stores are available in large and small markets across the country, and their franchising experts will help you find a location that's just right.
Plus, there's financing for those who qualify and special programs for military veterans. The time to promote yourself to business owner could be now. Visit theupsstorefranchising.com/focus to get started today. That's theupsstorefranchising.com/focus. We continue our interview series here at shop.org, brought to you by gainloans.com. And we're joined now by the CEO of Gatsby, Brent Bernstein. And Brett, if you don't mind, first of all, before we get into all of the minutiae of the business, you know, a lot of the businesses here at shop.org, they start out because there's a problem and they want to create a solution for it. They see some sort of white space there. So what was the problem that Gatsby sought when you created it to kind of solve for?
Sure. Thanks, Trent. So the main problem we find, the thing we want to solve for, is making influencer marketing and just social media in general a more genuine space.
Influencer marketing, that's something that we see a lot of it here at shop.org, a lot of mentions about Instagram and that type of thing. We probably have some listeners that aren't super familiar with influencer marketing, despite the fact that it's been talked about in small portions on the show before. So what is influencer marketing?
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways to define it, and it's changed. It's been around for millennia, right? Now it's just the current form of it takes place on Instagram or other social media channels, but it's tapping into celebrities and people with influence to represent your product.
With Gatsby, one of the unique things is that you found that it's not always the enormously popular Instagram followers that can push out and have an effect, a positive effect on product, right? So what is your focus as far as influencers and connecting them with retailers?
What we're focused on right now is customers first, right? So there's been a trend in the last year from mega influencers, those with agents and make a living off of their influence on different networks, primarily Instagram. That's still happening, but there's been a new focus around micro-influencers. There's been a lot of studies done that show that the engagement levels on somebody's Instagram feed actually decrease as they increase follower sizes, right? This actually makes logical sense because as you become bigger, people follow you, they don't actually know who you are, then all of a sudden the engagement decreases, right? If I post something about my life, my followers are my friends and family, they will like it because they know who I am, right? So this idea of tapping into people with smaller followings became very exciting for brands. The problem is, A, how do you find the right people with smaller followings? And then B, how do you manage, you know, rather than one celebrity post, hundreds, if not more, of people who have smaller followings? So we've sought out to make that a easier process with one caveat. Our unique proposition here is let's focus uniquely on the customers that you already have as a brand. Find out which of them have influence and work with them directly.
You mentioned bringing in data and figuring out who's who in terms of influencers, who has influence. How does that work, at least from the retailers? And let's say I have an e-commerce site. I'm looking to get some of the micro-influencers into my stable a little bit. How does Gatsby help to facilitate that?
Sure. Well, step one is just identification of who has what degree of influence. And I use influence. I mean, the word influence right now is being thrown around a lot. The way I'm defining it right now is merely reach, right? How much following they have on a certain network. And when you're dealing with people with, you know, micro-influencer space, bots are not really a big issue, right? You and me, I'm not sure about you, Trent, but I don't have bots, right? My follower counts are pretty small. Like, I'm just a genuine, normal social media user who posts about my life through my feeds, right? And the people that follow me are my friends. I don't want to have bots liking my stuff. It makes no sense. The average person does not want to have bots. They don't need to. They don't need to inflate their following counts. So we live in a world where all of a sudden the follower size you have at a micro level is actually a good indication of how much reach you have. We are going to get into a lot more around measuring influence at a much more granular and sophisticated level. But for now, we're focusing on the follower size. I ask brands all the time, do you know which of your customers have which degree of reach? The answer is always no. There's no CRM tool like that today that exists, because how do you identify that? How do you capture that information? So what we do is we allow brands to easily set up a campaign or, you know, some sort of button on their website that encourages their shoppers to engage with them with the explicit purpose of linking that social following number back to a portal for them to look at and review.
Okay, so once a customer from that particular brand enters into kind of the database, what type of data can you get? What type of data can you track from that customer?
So at this point today, looking at things like their name, their email address, general location based upon what they've put into Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, their age range, time zone, and then most interestingly enough, their followers and following numbers. And this is all available through CSV and other, you know, export functions so that you can sort and filter by that data. So you have all the pieces you need. You have their profile picture as well. I should say that profile picture displayed. You have their email address. You have their follower size. At this point, you can go and reach out to them directly and say, well, you have 5,000 followers. You also seem to like pets. We're a pet supply manufacturer, right? We sell pet beds. Would you care for a, you know, send a picture out about your bed the next month? We'll give you a free bed. That's the idea. Someone who has 10,000 followers might earn two beds or a different product, right? That's the idea, is that right now, giving the brands that data is power to go and figure out which of their customers would make good advocates or influencers for them.
So based on the businesses that are customers of Gatsby, is there a difference between businesses and which followers or which social media influencers they go after? For example, we talk about an influencer that has a 10,000 person influence. Well, let's say we make pet products. Is there a sweet spot for some businesses that's actually below that, where there appears to be more of an authentic nature around it?
So this is the best part, is that right now the term micro-influencer, the definition is not solidified in the industry. I hear numbers like 10,000 followers is a good number for that term. I hear 100,000 followers is a good number for that term, right? I don't want to set a number. My definition of it, which I've told in other podcasts and other media outlets, is people who don't make a living off of their following. That's what I define as a micro-influencer, or some brands call them advocates. So people that just don't have need to have bots or other things that remove the authenticity of it, right? So with that in mind, everybody has some degree of influence, right? Let's say I only have 5 followers on my Instagram feed, but all 5 of them are my best friends, and everything I do, they want to copy. That's influence. It's not about the number. It's just about being authentic. And so we use the number today as a good barometer of that, but we're going to get into a lot more metrics to help give some more definitions around that influence score.
So it's not so much about breadth as it is depth, right? Because if I'm a brand, I want whatever that influencer posts, I want that to turn into site traffic.
Exactly. I mean, that's the end goal. The end goal is brand awareness, it's conversions, it's also understanding and insights. So if you look at our logo, it's a new logo that we designed. It looks like glasses on the side because it's about insights, right? And sophistication, and people perceive glasses to have those two representations, right? And we're in that boat.
We walked through kind of a representation of how, if I were a business, I could install something on my site to try and drive or collect some of this consumer data as far as influencers. On the back end of things, if I'm retailer X and I have an e-commerce site, how do I go about installing some of the Gatsby aspects onto my site? How easy is it to implement?
So we have a Shopify app pending with their team. So we'll have that ability for brands to install on the Shopify platform very easily, with just a couple clicks of a button, very soon. We also have other platforms available in the App Store also pending. But right now it's also very easy just to create an account on our website. It's just Gatsby.ai. And within about 5 minutes, you could create a campaign. And then as long as you can just copy and paste a single line of code, you could have Gatsby up and running. And at that point, it's really interesting, Trent, because the brand then can decide. We have some brands that are really active managing their Gatsby campaign, going through the data on an ongoing daily basis, and some that just set it and forget it. And at that point, they'll continuously engage with their customers on social media and check back in every few weeks or months. It's up to the brand how much they want to engage with the Gatsby campaign.
In addition to kind of walking through that prototype, I know a lot of businesses here obviously are developing things for the future, have their eye set in the future. Quickly evolving industry, just the area of influencers, quickly evolving industry. So what's next for Gatsby, so to speak?
Yeah, so I'll be careful not to speak about too much that I want to keep secret. But I've told this, you know, this is not really too much of a secret. It's pretty clear where we're going. The first problem that we wanted to solve that you asked, the very first question you asked today was, what are we solving? The first thing I answered was genuine influence, right? Making sure that it's people that are genuinely your customers. By putting this campaign on your website, you've already had the first metric vetted. That is that they are a customer on your website before they're an influencer. Check mark done. The next thing is, because you're managing now a micro-influencer campaign network, you're working with a lot more people. The process to manage a lot of people is much harder than managing 1 or 2 mega influencers with agents and everything else. So we want to allow for some automations to allow brands to set up some parameters, make it really easy for them to basically define what they want to do at a campaign level, and then let Gatsby go to work, making the offers and managing the campaigns for them automatically.
As we wrap this up, yesterday we were talking to you, we were visiting at the booth, and I can't remember whether it was Leighton or myself, we asked, where's the name come from? And you said, We should save that for the podcast. So I want to ask you now, where does the name Gatsby come from?
Yeah. So Trent, if I can put you on the spot here, do you have any guesses?
Book, obviously.
Yeah, the book is part of it.
That would be one. But outside of that, no, I'm open to interpretation. Sure. You're not bootlegging or anything, right?
No. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the work from Fitzgerald. Here's the story. So when I started with, you know, the idea of Gatsby, I spent 2 days thinking about names, and I did all the traditional startup things where I removed vowels or I pushed words together, just made things funky and weird and hard to spell. And I would go to, you know, I'm sure I had a feature where I would tell somebody the name and they would type it wrong, right? Hated all those things. So instead, on my desk at the time was a stack of books. Top of the stack was The Great Gatsby. And for some reason, my mind went to a very specific mention in the book, and that is the, you know, the parties, right? Everyone loves the parties. Everyone guesses the parties are involved with the answer to this question. And they are. You know, Jay Gatsby threw these elaborate parties. The whole town of West Egg showed up. But except for the Nick Carraway character, nobody received an invitation. They all showed up through word of mouth. So Gatsby draws a crowd through word of mouth, and that's what our Gatsby does as well.
Nice. I like that. That's a very good explanation. I like the fact that you didn't remove a vowel, so I had to insert the A in Gatsby either. So.
Nope, no, nothing removed, nothing added. It's just Gatsby, .ai.
Brett Bernstein, the founder, CEO of Gatsby. Thanks so much for joining us on the Retail Focus podcast, and enjoy the last few hours here at shop.org.
Appreciate it.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Once again, we'd like to thank Brett Bernstein for joining us on the Retail Focus podcast, that interview recorded back at shop.org in our interview series brought to you by Gain Loans and GainLoans.com. We turn on the Retail Focus to look at Black Friday and Cyber Monday sales as the figures are rolling in. And as we compare this year's strong numbers over 2016's, let's take a look at some of the individual products as well that sold nicely during the course of the Thanksgiving shopping weekend. Retail milestones were hit on Friday with Adobe Digital Insights reporting $5 billion in digital sales, at least $5 billion, that is, during the 24-hour period on Friday. Almost a 17% increase here, which topped some other more modest increases we saw leading up to the day of 10 to 15%. Now, Adobe here tracks the 100 largest e-commerce hubs based in the U.S. for this analysis. Initial analysis and predictions regarding Cyber Monday sales said that they would eventually reach $6 billion, $1 billion more than Friday's digital impact. Business Insider, meanwhile, reported that Amazon brought in 45% of the transactions, not sales dollars here, but transactions on Thanksgiving, and 54.9% of the transactions on Friday. Now, this would be e-commerce transactions, not e-commerce and store transactions combined. You have 12.78 million transactions between both of these for Amazon. And what's interesting here, this is pretty much in line with where they were in terms of transactional online market share 1.5 years ago, where they brought in nearly 55% of the sales pie annually. So they took a little bit of a hit if you're looking at year-over-year market share from Amazon, not year-over-year sales. This report went on to say that Walmart had the next highest number of transactions, followed by Best Buy, Kohl's, and Target. Looking at ShopperTrack, they reported brick and mortar traffic was nearly even. It was only down. It was down about less than 1% year over year for Black Friday. Now, keep in mind, as Layton and I said during last week's Retail Focus, that because of this Thanksgiving creep, you're likely to see fewer sales and less foot traffic in stores on Black Friday than you saw last year. So while it is a drop, and while it is mentioned as a drop, that drop is much slimmer than what we thought, and overall, your total foot traffic comps fell about 2%, but according to the NRF data, people were spending more in stores in general. So despite the fact that foot traffic comps are down, according to ShopperTrack, people are spending much more per ticket. And that's where you might see that boost in same-store sales. And that's where Layton comes in. He's going to talk a little bit about overall spending.
And this is what I think a lot of our listeners want to hear about. What is the overall retail landscape looking like for this Black Friday season? And you look at Black Friday as a holiday, it's not just Friday anymore in terms of a shopping season or a shopping holiday. whatever you would say about it, it's really Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday now. You see, as Trent noted, that Cyber Monday sales were actually going to be increased over Friday's digital sales. As we take a broader look at the overall spending during this last retail weekend, a lot of money was spent. In fact, $19.62 billion between all channels meaning brick and mortar and digital sales, a 15% bump from 2016's numbers. And this is really for the time frame Thursday through Monday, so that's an important caveat here. And in terms of GDP, I ended up researching retail GDP from 2016. This makes up almost 1% of the entire retail impact pie. So a really big bump in sales means a really good thing for a lot of retailers, especially those publicly traded companies. And I think that's why you see the stock prices up during the last few days or so. Right in line with our expectations, or actually beating our expectations from last week's podcast, 174 million Americans joined in the retailing festivities during this period. And you see that this means it exceeded the NRF guidance that we brought forth. 51 million people said they only participated in brick and mortar, 58 million people only online, 64 million participated in both. And you see that numbers increase because obviously there are people that want to participate, get the feel of those physical stores, but also get all of those digital deals that you'll see on Amazon. Customers who did shop at both spent about $80 more on average, which makes sense and really emphasizes, drives home the point about how important it is for retailers to promote their omni-channel capabilities if they have them. Kohl's and Target were recently praised for their efforts here, particularly Kohl's. Some are speculating that they could be a potential buyout in the future from Amazon because of Kohl's recent success and the partnerships they have going on with Amazon's digital offerings. And you see that online-only shoppers brought more in than brick-and-mortar-only shoppers. And this makes a little bit of sense because if you think of the mental construct here, Trent, you're talking about a lot of minimum free shipping offers. If you have to spend $50 or $75 or $100 to get free shipping, this is a really big incentive for a lot of customers to hit those marks. But what this means for the e-commerce retailer is more revenue. So a lot of companies were able to take advantage of this, and I think that's why people spent more online on average than they did in brick and mortar stores. Overall, if you spent $335 while shopping during this past weekend, you actually ended up meeting the average of the other 174 million shoppers, which really puts into context how much people are willing to spend, unlock those pocketbooks, if you will. But if you put this in the overall holiday shopping perspective, the average American spends between $700 between the months of November and December. This means that almost half, or around 45% or so, of the total holiday sales came in during this past Black Friday weekend. Just an astounding figure, and a figure that really drives home the point that all of these media headlines talking about all of these sales, this is very important for retailers. This is their one day of the year, or one time frame of the year, that they're really able to showcase all of their product offerings and really offer their most loyal customers these exclusive discounts.
Let's look at some of the products that were available during the Black Friday weekend and some of the more notable discounts. Massive discounts still circulated more around consumer electronics. Typically what we see on Thanksgiving and Black Friday with televisions and computers getting the bulk of the promotional pricing, followed by toys. And Amazon said basically that toys were successful in being sold, with over 200,000 sold on the marketplace platform in the first few hours of their sales over the weekend. Toys, an area we talked about a lot in the months leading up to the holidays, and it wasn't just us, but also JCPenney and other retailers. JCPenney added toys as they look to utilize their store's square footage. We've discussed in the past how much JCPenney is using the toys in terms of imagery in a lot of their marketing now around this time of year. Adobe Digital Insights said that the Nintendo Switch was a best-selling item on all three of the big spending days. PS4s and Xbox One consoles could not even get close to what the Nintendo Switch brought to the market. Wolfenstein 2 was reportedly the best-selling video game. Also near all-time highs, interestingly enough, gun sales. Although there's not too much hard data regarding this, retailers certainly did report an increased number of gun sales during this period of time. Media outlets such as CNN have talked about the record number of back checks via the FBI, 200,000 3,000 in all versus 185,000 same point in time last year. Gun stores and sporting goods retailers reported selling a bulk of handguns, but also shotguns. Lastly, in terms of what we bought, well, Leighton, I understand you bought goods that you typically consume ordinarily.
That's right. I didn't get too fancy this year in terms of holiday spending. I did not have a big screen TV to buy. I didn't have a new computer to buy, although I would like a new computer for the podcast, but I'm waiting on Santa to potentially give me one. Last year, I bought a tablet at Sam's Club, and to be honest, Trent, I've only used it 3 times. So I told myself this year I was only going to keep spending to those items I normally consume, and that has to do with joint supplements because my knees hurt now that I'm older, and a pair of new running shoes on Amazon that were on sale. I also bought a USB splitter that was not on sale. But overall, if you're asking me how much I saved during this Black Friday event, or I ended up buying most of these items on Cyber Monday, I saved around $38. So for me, I didn't spend a lot of money, but I actually ended up with those shoes coming in around the average consumer spending level, around $300 to be exact. Only this year is the year I didn't get too excited about all the events surrounding this holiday shopping season. Amazon was really the place I shopped at most. However, I did buy a luggage set previous to Black Friday in the overall week there at Target. This was on sale for around $50. It was a good deal there. So to be honest, Trent, I participated in both brick and mortar and online, and for that I feel accomplished. But overall, I didn't necessarily hit the average spending amount that a lot of people were spending in these retail outlets.
I didn't come close, to be quite frank, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that I was traveling. But if anyone's interested, I did get a couple of running shirts at Adidas, and an Adidas retail store that had some great Black Friday sales. Got those for a huge markdown, about a 60% markdown. I also hit up a few grocery stores and took advantage of some Black Friday deals at the grocery stores, and a few websites sent some good Black Friday deals along, as well as some sports tickets websites, which I went ahead and took advantage of there. But I too made it nowhere near the amount that the typical American spent, at least the typical American shopper spent, $335. I made it probably less than 30% of that mark, if we're being completely honest. So I may not be doing my job in terms of keeping retailer same store sales up, but I promise you I make that difference up during the rest of the year.
Albertsons and Instacart have inked a massive 1,800-store deal that will be rolled out quicker than most grocery delivery store services have been in the past. Instacart was founded in 2012 and by a former Amazon employee, in fact, and they've already been able to partner with some of the heaviest hitters in the grocery industry, including the aforementioned Kroger, who just had their earnings, Costco, Natural Grocers, and Whole Foods, among others. Whole Foods has actually been able to cite a lot of positivity through this Instacart partnership that they've actually expanded over the recent months. Based in San Francisco, this should be no surprise, Instacart is really grown over the past 5 years to be a powerhouse in the grocery delivery sector. Instacart, through these partnerships, has become highly regarded in the space because of the reliance on data and transparency with their operating partners. They offer different services tailored for different customer needs. So obviously they have been able to partner with companies and really benefit them by having 1-hour delivery windows or same-day shipping delivery windows. And this is exactly what Albertsons is wanting and probably why they got on board with Instacart as a platform. Speaking of diversification in markets, they have been steadily gained throughout the U.S., now having an eastern half concentration that is massive. If you look at the location map on Instacart's website, instacart.com, you can really see the eastern half of the United States is highly concentrated, but they are actually making a lot of big strides throughout the Midwest. And you see throughout the western half of the United States, particularly in California, they also have a high concentration. To capture market share in those areas, their website, again, instacart.com, uses IP address data to showcase stores that utilize their services when you visit their homepage. So their homepage, interestingly enough, isn't just a standard homepage. It automatically directs you to some of the companies that they've been partnered with around your zip code. So this is an interesting thing that they've been able to leverage and really gain traction with. And I think a lot of their partners are excited about this fact that if you go to their homepage, let's say you live by a Costco, it'll say, shop at Costco now. And it's crazy to see that a lot of other websites, a lot of other entities like Instacart have not done this to date. Like Uber, they flaunt the idea of having part-time flexibility for their workers and having a growing store base to ensure constant work. They continue to expand beyond groceries, eyeing retail pharmacy operators such as CVS as well. So this is at a time when a lot of people want more convenience with not only groceries, Trent, but pharmaceutical goods and other offerings. Really a massive market opportunity for both Instacart and a great partnership opportunity for Albertsons.
And Albertsons has had some struggles in the recent past. They're trying to work past those with a new investment in a grocery chain in Texas. And as we discussed on a previous podcast from the Food Focus, they're looking to pay down debt and refresh some of their stores. This Instacart deal is a way they can attract more customers that don't want to have to drive to the store, even if it means picking up groceries curbside, like at a Kroger or Walmart or several Albertsons locations already. Now, Albertsons does have store pickup at certain locations already, and they also have delivery, which we'll be talking about in this story, but the delivery is only certain markets. This deal from Instacart is in addition to Albertsons' current delivery structure. So it's going to run parallel with Albertsons' current delivery structure, which again, as I mentioned, only available in certain markets. Boise, Idaho, for example, as one of these markets. Currently, Albertsons allows customers in those markets to choose delivery windows, so an hour or a general period of the day when those groceries might be delivered. Additionally, they're promoting these services highly on their website with $25 off and free delivery on a customer's first order on a minimum $100 order. Albertsons' current delivery scheme offers free delivery when buying participating items as well. For example, including one baby item and a large order will earn free delivery at the moment. And these promotions rotate depending on what type of groceries you buy and depending on the brand of the groceries that you buy. So this Instacart rollout will not only be expansive, but quickly rolled out as well. Albertsons, by mid-2018, will have 1,800 locations being serviced, at least according to Instacart. This will be, of course, an intense worker buildup for Instacart in order to facilitate the needs of Albertsons. To provide more color on how big this will be, this deal will encompass over 78% of Albertsons' massive 2,300 store base. The 2,300 number is a reflection of Safeway, Amigos, Pavilions, United, and more, a much larger footprint than the current Albertsons delivery platforms, it appears. Pricing will be streamlined and fairly competitive in nature. When you look at the pricing structure, customers can pay $5.99 per order, or they can subscribe to the service with a $14.99 fee that covers 30 days of unlimited delivery. This is cheaper than Albertsons' existing in-house delivery, which is $10 or $9.95 for purchases of $150 or more, and $12.95 on purchases under $150, plus a fuel surcharge where applicable. There is a $30 minimum purchase for delivery as well in Albertsons' current program. Here we see the benefit to the consumer in terms of pricing when a retailer outsources this to a firm that operates largely through contract labor, whereas Albertsons does not have a lot of the same luxuries that Instacart does by being able to externally contract with employees, rather doing a lot of that in-house and having to hire delivery employees on, which is expensive, and the cost here gets delivered on to the consumer. Now, we want to talk about immediate tie-ins from previous stories we've covered, and Leighton, in October, Albertsons announced a massive deal to sell off a portion of its stores in a sales leaseback, and that's kind of where the dominoes started falling for Albertsons. They've been quick in coming lately.
Since Albertsons is a privately held retailer or grocery retailer, we can't exactly see what they're doing with that $720 million, as we reported on either the Food Focus or Retail Focus podcast, I forget which. But we talked about this deal and the substantial nature of it because this encompassed 71 stores and multiple banners. But if you look at just the 71 stores, it's amazing they were to extract $720 million from the sale leaseback deal. But we knew in turn that they were going to be doing something with that money. And this is something that the company had been talking about. A lot of rumors about an IPO over the last few years. But they really need to be able to reduce the debt on their balance sheet, one. And two, they need to improve customer service. And I think here, this is something where they're investing a lot of this money, or at least a partial amount of this money, into that customer service aspect. The proceeds not only were set to pay off that debt, but they're looking to improve all facets of their business, and that includes customer connectivity and convenience. So this Instacart partnership really plays a key role in doing those particular things. Another deal we discussed here on the podcast here recently was the Plated buyout, where Albertsons essentially decided to buy a third-party meal kit delivery service, similar to that of Blue Apron, instead of having something created in-house, something that Kroger has done here recently. However, looking through those deal details, we couldn't really see how much they paid for that, but we could see that that actually ended up closing before the sale leaseback deal. So they used some capital that was already offhand before that deal was announced. All of this ties into the all-important brand awareness that they want to bring to the table. The September deal with Plated was talked about by Plated CEO as providing the necessary scale for the Albertsons business. And surrounding all of these deals, you really see how scale is important in the grocery sector. You look at scale as not just a way to reduce costs overall. You think of economies of scale, reducing the cost of goods sold, therefore delivering higher margins to your initial investors. But you're talking about scale in order to just reach more people in general to boost that top line revenue. So as it pertains to Plated, as it pertains to Instacart, using their platforms and all of the technology behind that, I had mentioned the IP address data from Instacart, it enables Albertsons to really gain traction online. This is something that they really haven't had before, but something that executive teams have really shown an interest in. Being able to go to Instacart.com, being near an Albertsons, and having that be the first business that pops up is extremely important and extremely valuable. This is one of the reasons why I'm upset they are not yet a publicly traded company, because we can't see how much value that really is in terms of how much the partnership is. So this is going to be something that we will be looking forward to. And you see the massive amount of locations that Trent touched on, 1,800 locations. Again, that leaves white space for around 500 locations. I'm curious to see how this Instacart deal plays out. Again, providing that all essential analytical data tool for Albertsons. I'm sure they're going to be expanding the partnership in the years to come. The big striking detail for me, at least within this story, is how fast they're going to implement this. And this is something that Kroger has done with their curbside pickup, their clickless platform. This is something that all companies are really looking towards to stay competitive in this growing landscape. So it really is a weird notion to think that Walmart, for instance, or Amazon is going to take the entire piece of the grocery pie when companies like Albertsons are continually reinvesting into their platform and still reporting some decent same-store sales gains.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I tell you about a story that we're looking ahead to, we're keeping an eye on for the next week or the next month, and we begin with Leighton.
My story has to do with Toys R Us and an impending bankruptcy, as we had talked about on a previous edition of the Retail Focus. A bonus plan for top executives actually outlines $32 million in compensation for around 17 executives. This story is by way of CNBC, and you can actually get the entire story on Westlaw Next Practitioner Insights. If you look at the story, this is very interesting because a watchdog group working for the government is actually saying that this is going to be something that defies logic. The fact that they're able to pay out so much compensation to executives that have essentially created a bankruptcy for the company, not because of the compensation bonuses here, but because the company is failing right now. It's doing very poorly in terms of sales and profit margins, yet there's still apparently enough money to go around for executive teams. So this is something that I am curious about as we head into the bankruptcy proceedings and have a little bit more light shed on the overall happenings within their business operationally. And I am curious to see, of course, how Toys R Us did during the holiday season. A lot of sales, like Trent had mentioned previously, in the Amazon business were from toys. And so I wonder how much of the piece of the pie was taken from Toys R Us and whether or not that's going to affect them longer term if they have to potentially close more locations, and what this story has to do with maybe changing the executive format around, changing the compensation. Perhaps those bonuses may magically go away after the story reaches a larger audience. But that is it for my looking ahead story, something I'm going to be keeping an eye on certainly as we go through the next few months.
Well, I'm looking ahead to Five Below, the retail store chain that offers products priced below $5 each. has been on the upswing, at least in terms of their stock, but it's not the stock I'm looking ahead to. You see, earlier this year, analysts said that with the decline in popularity in fidget spinners, that Five Below was going to take a little bit of a hit on their bottom line because they weren't going to be able to keep the streak going among tweens. Well, what's interesting is that in their most recent quarter, comparable store sales were up 8.5%. And now I'm interested in how Five Below fared during Black Friday, because tweens, let's face it, tweens and teens both have different Black Friday shopping habits than do their parents, who are buying a lot larger items, a lot of these consumer electronics. And Five Below has become a little bit of a go-to, at least it's said that they've become a go-to, for teens and tweens getting gifts for other people their age because of the cheaper price point and because oftentimes the money isn't flowing if you're 13 years old and you have a modest allowance. So Five Below could be in position to cash in. The real question here, yes, the fidget spinner market is probably already cornered and saturated, but above and beyond that, during that craze, did Five Below build up even more brand recognition among this age group? And how much of a pop are they going to get from holiday sales among this age group when they release their fourth quarter results? Layton and I probably think quite a bit, but I think the answer is wide open here, and you could see a wide range of results for Five Below, ranging from disappointing to wildly exciting if you're either a shareholder or a member of that company. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent. A big thanks to Brett Bernstein for joining us on this episode of the podcast from Gatsby, talking about micro-influencers. We'll be back next week with another version of the Retail Focus Podcast. Same area, same place. Be sure and check us out on Spotify, as we're now on that platform as well.
Been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.